Hi, my name is Doug Westerbeek, and I am the author of A Short Walk Through a Wide World.
Can you go home again? Sometimes not. When Aubrey Tourvel becomes unexpectedly ill in 1880s Paris, she discovers that the only cure is to continuously move around the world, outrunning her mysterious disease, never to return to any place she has visited. Author Douglas Westerbeek's A Short Walk Through a Wide World follows Aubrey's travels and dangerous adventures that span the globe three times over. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Douglas Westerbeek. Okay, so this doesn't seem fair for me to ask you to do this for this large book, but could you give our listeners a brief description of it?
It's not a problem. I'll give you my elevator pitch. So,
perfect.
So Aubrey Tourvel is a little girl in 1880s Paris, and she's sitting at dinner with her family, and all of a sudden at the dinner table, she gets really violently sick, starts spasming and shuddering and everything, and the family freaks out. They don't know what to do. They rush her to the hospital, and when she gets there, she's fine. And the doctors say, I don't see anything wrong with her. So she goes back home, but she can't even get inside her house because it comes on again. And she's sick and she's coughing up blood this time. It's even worse. They rush her back to the hospital. And this time they all see it. And the doctors they're freaked out as well. And they're holding her down because she's spasming and all this. And they're trying to help, but she just can't take it. It is just too much. So she breaks away. She rushes out of the hospital. She runs off into the streets of the city of Paris at night, and she feels better. And she realizes it's this act of exploration, this going somewhere she's never been before, that cures her. And so she spends the rest of her life wandering around and around the world, constantly on the run from this disease. And so it's an epic adventure course. She like crosses the Sahara, she climbs the Himalayas, she rafts the Amazon, all this kind of stuff. It's a travelogue almost inherently because she goes to so many places. It's a character study. We follow her whole life from like the young age of 9 years old all the way till she's like an old lady at the end. And what else would you call it? You call it a spiritual journey. There are threads of philosophy thrown without it. But I think mostly at its heart, I would call it an adventure. I would call it a spiritual journey. She's thrust off into this adventure she wants no part of. She doesn't know where it's going. She doesn't know why she's being made to do this, but she is. And it's kind of a reluctant pilgrim's progress, I guess you say, something like that.
You know, Aubrey has to keep moving to new locations, and she can never return. If she does, she dies. And it reminds me of like a shark having to move or else it dies, unless that's a myth. I'm not quite sure if that's accurate or not.
No, I think that's true. I've heard that too.
But it also had, you know, like a 1001 Arabian Nights feel to it. But instead of Scheherazade telling a story to spare her life, Aubrey is living a new story in a new town to save hers. Are there any echoes of other books in here, or did you find inspiration in any of your favorite reads?
It came from all over the place. I suppose, I mean, what you're saying is on the money as well, like 1001 Arabian Nights, because there's lots of stories inside stories, and she starts telling a story and then she'll get cut off and then she'll continue the story with someone else. So yeah, that was very, and then she, you know, there's a subplot, maybe I guess you call it, with the libraries, and there's stories inside the libraries and they just keep continuing. So yeah, there's a lot of that in there. I took a lot of inspiration from authors like, well, obviously the magical realism authors, Marquez and Bulgakov. There's Dante, because it is a spiritual journey. It's the entire Divine Comedy goes on this giant journey with a divine revelation at the end. That's very similar to what Aubrey's about to go through. Somerset Maugham was a huge influence. I love Somerset Maugham. I love his conversational style. I love everything about him. And actually, when I originally wrote my very first draft, was written very much in the style, like a pastiche almost, of Somerset Maugham. But I was asked to like tone that down because it's, you know, it's a little outdated these days. And he was a great travel writer, and he lived in the same time period, and that inspired a lot of it. And I should say something about the time period as well, because I'm asked like, why 1880s? Why not today? And I was thinking, well, because if you said it today, she's just going to be sitting around in airports the whole book, and that's not going to be nearly as exciting. But back in the 1880s, you know, if you start off there, then she's going to be going by foot, by train, by boat, by biplane in one scene, I think it is Curtis Falcon. I don't know if it's, is it a biplane? I can't remember. But you know, it's a much more exciting story if you start back then and than if you do now. But yeah, so I got inspiration from all kinds of places like that. Came from really from everywhere.
And her family would only have to like check her location on the phone if that were happening now.
Yeah, that's a really good point too. I didn't even think of that. That's right.
So what Aubrey is experiencing isn't exactly wanderlust, but more like exile. But she does recognize that the more you move, the more available you are to chance and little wonders, and that discovery lies where no one is looking. So talk to me about the idea of the things on Earth existing only because Aubrey, or anyone for that matter, has, you know, beheld them. Is beheld a word?
I hope so, because I
Okay.
use it in the
Okay.
book. Yeah. Well, that was the idea. So she's, like you said, she's living a life in permanent exile. So she's got no family, she's got no home. All her love affairs are brief and, you know, brokenhearted at the end. And so she's got to kind of find a meaning in, like, well, how do you find a meaning in this kind of existence? And it takes her kind of a while to really understand that she is seeing things no one else gets to see. And actually, it comes to her slowly. And I think she doesn't even realize that at first. But that alone, there's another line in the book. If you can't make your life, if I remember it right, if you can't make your life meaningful, make it extraordinary. And so the idea is that, well, maybe there's a choice here. You can either try to make it meaningful, or you can make it extraordinary. But actually, I think she manages both because her journey is extraordinary. And just the fact that she has seen these things and that she is able to pass them on if she wants to gives her life a meaning. It's, I was trying to describe this to another interviewer and I utterly failed. But when she's traveling around the world, when anybody is living their life, just because we're all individuals, we're all going to experience it in a different way. And some of us end up having our stories never told. You know, not everybody understands. We all die alone. I mean, there's a lot of stuff we have to do alone. But even within that, what we can pass on, even if it's just a little amount, it takes a part in this great march forward. I guess this kind of, this is going to sound really pretentious of me, but this kind of Hegelian march forward, you know, like this generation adds to this generation and we keep moving forward because of that. And Aubrey is a part of that march, and maybe like one of the bigger parts, because she has seen so much. And really some of the tension of the story is actually others trying to make her understand that, because she just looks at her life as like this continuing torture. Everyone else is saying, no, you've got this amazing life, and she's having a hard time believing it. So yeah, I mean, what you behold really becomes you, and it becomes what you can pass on to other people as well. I guess that's how I would sum it up.
There was also a part in the book where people experience time in different ways. You know, people live different lives, but they also experience time in different ways. And I'm wondering, there's a paragraph on page 162 about time. Would you mind reading it to us?
Not at all. Time to Aubrey was the rhythm tapped out by her footsteps in the changing climate. To the people in the village below, time was measured by the daily routine, the crowing roosters, the udders of their goats, the ripening of their barley. Time was long for the young lovers who waited for night, short for the old men who lived past their use. It was slow in the mountain villages, fast in the bustling cities. She'd once floated down the Colorado River, and time lengthened like a beard until the rapids cut it short again. It fascinated her, this malleability. She wondered if time slowed down for deserters facing the firing squad, for sailors in a storm, then sped up again while playing croquet or reading a favorite book. Did time ever stop? Would it wait for you to catch up? Would it hurry on ahead? And then, suddenly, she was in the low valleys, as if no time had passed at all. That one?
Yeah, I love that one. And you know, at one point, someone remarks to Aubrey, I think it was the prince, it seems like the world you travel through is not the same world we travel through. So talk to me about this idea, this different world, and the difference in time for Aubrey.
Yeah, so it originally began because I wanted to obscure the time. I think that just helped make it feel like a more epic journey if you're not doing it strictly in chronological order, if it's mixed up, if there's a timeless quality to this passage of time. And she makes several points throughout the book. I'm not a statistician. I'm a walker. I don't keep track of this stuff. I just walk. I don't like to think back. I don't like to count the years. She even loses track of how old she is. And that felt important because I wanted it to feel like a timeless journey through time and space, as I guess people will say.
You've touched on this a little bit, but Aubrey feels almost as if she's being punished by constantly having to move, but others see it as freedom. Because, you know, people locked in a jail cell may travel three steps from one wall to another and live their whole lives confined. And others see her situation as a reward because, you know, things that never move are only half of what they can be. So what do you think? Punishment or reward?
To me, I mean, a lot of us, most people love to travel. Not everybody, but most people love to travel. So it seems like a reward. I would love to go off and trace around the world like Aubrey does. At the same time, though, if you really think about it, do you really want to? Because most people just, you know, they'll go on a vacation to break the routine, to see something new. But, you know, home is important. People want to come back and maybe they'll take some of the outside world back with them. Maybe they won't. But the idea is that it's temporary and we love our home. You know, I love my wife and my kids and all that. I can't go tracing around the world of my own. I don't know if I actually, as romantic and as wonderful as it sounds, I don't really know if I would want to. My dad used to travel for a living, for example, and he hates to travel now. He's like, why? He just wants to sit at home and do nothing. My wife has to travel for her job. She just wants to be home, sit with the kids as well. So there's just a big plus and a minus to all of this. So travel is kind of like a fantasy, and it's a reward for, you know, you work hard and you get to go off to Tahiti for a couple of weeks, come back home, whatever it is. And all that is great and fun, but imagine having to do it day in, day out, nonstop. And then it becomes a whole different matter, right? So if you're reading this, you know, you're the reader, you're enjoying this epic adventure because it's almost like it's armchair travel. It's a fantasy that none of us are actually able to do unless of course you're Marco Polo or someone. But we get to live it vicariously through Aubrey. Aubrey, on the other hand, is the one who's actually doing it for us. She's not having the best time at all. She wants to settle down. She wants kids. She wants a home life. She wants to visit her folks again. All this kind of stuff. It's hard.
It feels like there are moments, or at least characters, of inspiration in this novel. You know, with the prince who, quote, defies the easy path in favor of the righteous one, or Vicente, who takes in lost children and he seems to be offering them like wisdom and guidance. Did you have an audience in mind when you wrote this? I mean, it was a fantastic read for me as an adult, but it also had the feeling of a timeless classic that, you know, precocious readers might devour.
I mean, you keep in mind that there's an audience who's going to read it, but generally I write for myself. You know, like, because, you know, I love to travel, like I was saying, love traveling. And so when I had this idea, I was like, oh, I could totally milk this. This is going to be a lot of fun to write. And I can throw her into all kinds of adventures, all kinds of situations. I can philosophize on travel because it's so interesting to me when you think about it. So, yeah, if you start limiting yourself to like an audience, I find people will end up writing stuff they don't believe in, or maybe it's very formulaic or market driven. But if you write for yourself, you're kind of free with all that. And all you can do is write the kind of book you want to read and just hope that other people like it too. I mean, what else are we going to do, right?
So Aubrey's travels span across the entire globe, and she's not a statistician or she doesn't keep track of data. She just walks. But did you plot her journey on a map?
I kind of did. And then I did my best to forget it and obscure it as much as I could. So I did that just because I knew I wanted, you know, these certain scenes and, okay, how are they going to happen? Where in the world were they going to happen? What would come first? So you end up mapping it, but then you kind of want to like hide it because you want this journey to seem epic. And in order to make it seem epic, you got to have this feeling like, you don't know where she's going to be next. There's maybe she's already been around the world three times and then this happens. You just don't know. And so I was trying to do that. So yeah, you do end up mapping it. I'm a very big outliner. the book begins as a one-page outline, then it'll be a 10-page or maybe a 50-page outline, then like a 100-page, and eventually I end up having with this big honking book. I tend to like flesh it out in layers like that. That's how I tend to write. And so, yeah, I had it all planned out right from the beginning. I knew exactly what was coming next and how she was going around here. But now that I'm thinking about it and saying all this out loud, it's not accurate because she does go around the world multiple times. And it's not possible that all these adventures happen this way and she only ages this much. So even though I had it in my head, it was wrong.
Did you have a favorite location to write about?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, kind of. I mean, they're all fun to write, but I mean, I've never been to the Himalayas. And so I got to research the hell out of the Himalayas, and that was so much fun. It was a rabbit hole. I learned that you can totally over research. I read so many books on the Himalayas. There's this great detail in one of the scenes where they're describing, they're in the tent and they're yak herders. So they get the yak roaming the hill and they eat the wild garlic that's growing in the hills. And then there's no trees anywhere. They burn their dung for fuel. So they're burning the dung in the tent, a little smoke hole at the top, but the whole tent has this delicate scent of wild garlic. And I it's a great detail, right? Like it feels, people read that, say, oh, he must have been there to know that. But I picked it up just like reading all this. I think that was from an article written by some people who are studying the indigenous people or their customs, and they were living with them for a while. And they described this in their article. And I was like, that's the best detail ever. I love this research in the Himalayas. I can't wait to go. So yeah, that was a favorite place of mine.
Now, I understand that this book was inspired by your work at the Cleveland Public Library. Is that accurate?
Sure was.
How so?
So I was working in that. I'd worked in like all the branches everywhere else. I ended up at some point in the literature department. And my boss, Amy Dawson, told me, you know what? You like to read. You should be a member of the Dublin Literary Committee. And to explain, the Dublin Literary Committee is a literary award that is picked by librarians around the world. So librarians all around the world who speak English or whatever, or reading in English anyway, will pick recent books that have come out in the past year. They'll pick their favorite three. They often in a committee and they all argue about it. And then they pick their three favorites. They send them off to the headquarters over in Dublin. And then, you know, they got some pro readers there who pick the best out of the bunch, the ones that everybody seems to have in common. Doing that, I was reading, you know, 50 to 100 books a year, all the recent releases, and it was just a huge education. It never passed my mind that I would write a novel before. I'd written before. I'd done like short stories and screenplays and things like that, but nothing like a novel. I always thought that was way beyond me. You had to have a special talent to do that. But then I started reading all these books, and a lot of them, I loved them all. And then after a while, I started getting more critical and I was like, well, I like that one more because this one doesn't do anything. And you start developing your own personal taste. And actually after a while, your personal style and all that was just a huge revelation. It demystified writing for me. And I thought, you know what? I could do this. My mom, when I was a kid, like what, 20, 30 years ago, used to say stuff like, you should write a novel. It's like in you, you should write one. I was like, no, only real writers do that. And I didn't listen to her. And I guess the moral is always listen to your mother. But yeah, that's how the library ended up. I wouldn't have written this without the library.
And I understand that you can see some of your mom in the Aubrey character. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So I didn't go in writing her with anybody in mind at all. It's her whole lifetime, which made her very fun to write. So you can start her off at 9 years old. She's a spoiled little kid. And then she's, you know, this sullen teenager because she's, you know, miserable wandering the world. And then comes to grips with that. And she's this kind of more fun-loving adult who's making friends everywhere she goes. And then she becomes a hermit in her old age. We go through all this. And after I was done with the book, I started recognizing, like, there's a bit of me when she's a little spoiled little brat and brat, right? And I wouldn't characterize myself as a sullen teen, but I've had those moments and I recognize that. I recognize my mom and the kind of fun loving, making friends everywhere she goes type. And then my grandmother, when she became a little more timid in her old age, I just started recognizing all of it. It was very intuitive to write her character. And I didn't realize any of this until after I'd finished.
I have never worked as a librarian, but I was a bookseller for 14 years. And I would imagine that they, you know, do the same thing of you have to have at the ready book suggestions and you have to listen to the reader to understand their likes and such so you do not recommend a bad book or the wrong book. So help me fill in the blank. A short walk through a wide world is for readers who like what?
I would go for adventures, epic adventures. I would go for that. I would go for armchair travelers. And I would go for people who are not opposed to a good spiritual kind of uplifting, an unexpectedly unlifting table. You're not going to get a conventional ending out of the book. So I might warn people about that. To me, the ending is very poetic. It's very beautiful. I hope that's what I was going for. But I would totally stress the epic adventure of it, because that's like, first and foremost, when you're writing something like this, you want it. Well, this is my philosophy anyway. You want to make it as exciting as you can, because you can make it as deep and profound a story as you can. But if it's not entertaining, nobody's going to read it. And it's so who cares? So you really want to write something that grabs their attention, is fun to read, but doesn't insult their intelligence at the same time. It's there's some meat to the bones, I guess, is what you say. You want some substance and entertainment.
Can you go home again?
Yeah, well, yeah, but to me, the stories where they don't are more interesting. I like, you know, Adam and Eve got kicked out of Eden for a good reason, because, you know, that's where the story of mankind really starts. But on the other hand, you know, the Odyssey is one of my favorite. I love epic poems, Beowulf. But the Odyssey, he gets kicked out of home. He goes off in this war. He wanders for 20 years, ends up back home with his family, with his wife and kid. And so he went back home again. It can go both ways. My stories, I've noticed, tend to end in places totally unlike where they began. They don't tend to go home again. I left home. I didn't go back, me personally. I mean, I love home and I love my family and everything else, but it just happened that way, and I'm fine with it. And I'm glad I got to see so much of the world. So,
we've talked about a lot. Is there anything that you'd like to talk about that I haven't asked?
So when I first wrote, I told you how I wrote right in layers. When I got to about, I don't know, 150, 200 pages, I sat down and I read it out loud to my wife for like took 3 or 4 nights, and we just sat there and I read it to her. And my wife is a musician. She plays violin with the Cleveland Orchestra. So when I got to the end, she said, "That was like music," and which is like a total bullseye for me. So I was like all excited. That's exactly the kind of feeling I was going for. I know not everybody's going to get that feeling. Some people want they're more like Tom Clancy readers or something like that. They want a more solid ending. This isn't like that. It's a little bit effusive. It's a little bit has a mystery to it, I suppose you'd say, but it's also, I think, very beautiful. And my theory is, my hope is that if you can recognize the beauty and the poetry in Aubrey's life, that the readers can recognize it in their own as well. So yeah, I guess I would say that's how I want people to walk away from the book feeling, I suppose.
Well, the novel is A Short Walk Through a Wide World. Doug Westerbeek, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was so much fun to be here.
That was Douglas Westerbeek, author of the book A Short Walk Through a Wide World, which was published by Avid Reader Press. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.